See you, Vic.
We're live.
Good evening, everyone. I would like to call the November 9th, 2020 study session of the University City Council to order. And I don't know if anyone has any changes to the agenda for tonight's public meeting of the regular session. Are there any changes? Mr. Rose?
Mayor, I would ask council to move item J2 and J3 from the consent agenda to the city manager's report.
Are there any other requested changes by any of my colleagues? Hearing none, we will make the request to change. I would assume, I think my colleagues will agree during the regular session, so thank you. The housing plan, Mr. Rose.
Honorable Mayor and council members, for several months we've been discussing among staff about the creation of a housing program for the city. Planning Director Clifford Cross has done some research. And so this is simply intended to begin the discussion of creating a plan and to at least get your thoughts on the direction that we're headed, recognizing that there is going to be outreach to the community as well as certainly this by no means is the final plan that we are proposing. So I want to stress just interested in getting your thoughts on the direction that we're headed. So I will turn things over to Mr. Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. I'll try to get my screen shared here. So did it pop up for y'all?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Hey, I'm off to a good start. as Mr. Rose had indicated, we've started to look into some different housing programs of other communities. And I myself have experience with them in terms of administering CDBG programs, LED programs, housing counseling programs, and various other types of rehab programs through where I was previously as an entitlement community. So we had an advantage there. So I think one of the purposes tonight is to kind of give you a background of where we currently are and some communities that we've looked at, specifically Columbia, and how they utilize these funds so we can start to put together a plan. And I think each of you were provided just a summary of a housing program that the staff put together. This in no way means that's the way we're going to go, but we thought it would be a nice supplemental document to have for you so you can look at it and kind of get an idea of where we're coming from and what we're thinking about. So I'm going to run through six or seven pretty quick slides, and then I wanted to save quite a bit of time for questions and answers with this. So what you see up on the screen is just an introduction to our housing program and policy. Nope, now is it not going? Okay, so I wasn't off to a good start. For some reason it's not going through. Let me try to fix this. All right, so let me try to share my other screen and I'll just do it the old fashioned. Okay, can you see that one?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to do it the old fashioned way. For some reason it's not doing the slideshow. So two programs that we look at traditionally, they come from HUD, Housing and Urban Development. I think everybody's aware of these programs. The first one is the most commonly known, the Community Development Block Grant Program. And the second one is the Home Investment Partnership Program. And these, as I had indicated, come from HUD. And these can reach a community in different ways. If you're an entitlement community, you automatically get so much every year based on your census. We are a part of an entitlement community, but that's basically St. Louis County. St. Louis County is an entitlement county, and then we seek funds from them on a yearly basis. I think on average, we seek about $100,000 a year, and about $75,000 of that traditionally goes to public works projects, and then $25,000 has gone to some police programs as well. We do have a few home rehab programs that we do get from that, but it's very limited. I think it's $10,000 a year. And that really doesn't do a lot, maybe two homes. And they apply directly through St. Louis County, who administers the program. The home program that's also administered by St. Louis County does a lot of the same things. It addresses rehab and updates and fixes to homes, such as mechanical issues and things like that. Currently, St. Louis County does this because they've got what they call a five-year consolidated plan. And maybe this will make more sense as I go along why I'm referencing the consolidated plan, because I really would like our housing program to basically, even though we're not required to have one, to mirror a five-year consolidated plan. So it gives us a document that kind of leads the path in how we're going and keeps us on course. But when you look at St. Louis County, they annually receive $5,666,736 in CDBG funds, which then is redistributed throughout multiple communities in the county. And as I said, we get roughly $100,000. So one of the things I think we need to look at as we move forward in the future, are we getting our fair share? Because a percentage of that money is based upon our census. So is $100,000 what we would get if we were a standalone entitlement community? And if it's not, then we need to work with them to ensure we get more. If that's something we can't get through them, then we might have to look at pulling out of that partnership and maybe applying directly to the state for those types of funds. They receive $3,623,107 in home funds. To date, I'm not aware of us receiving any home funds out of that money. So the community I wanted to talk to you about that I think we probably would want to mirror this upon would be Columbia, Missouri. And they are a standalone entitlement community that receives roughly $974,000 in CDBG funds on an annual basis, and an approximate $606,000 in home funds on a yearly basis. And the four primary programs that they do with this funding is they do home rehab and energy efficiency. So that's really a lot of your rehabilitation projects that could include like access ramps, maybe it fixed, they have an emergency repair program for furnaces that go out. And I think it's important to note the reason those are so important, especially for a community like us, is, as you know, a lot of home owner abandonment is the result of a homeowner who lives paycheck by paycheck and the furnace goes out in the winter and then they can't afford to fix it and they have no avenue to fix it. And it comes down to do you basically stop paying your mortgage and walk away from the home, or do you put food on your table? So I think that's the importance of that type of program. So we would have that available to those residents that get caught in that position. Another part of their program is an acquisition and demolition program. This would provide us money to continue and become more aggressive in demolition of properties that just quite honestly are not salvageable. And we could take them properties in and get them as part of some sort of land bank program or a land trust program that we can use to work with future private developers to promote infill development. There's also the homeowner assistance program. And this is a really important one because, and this is one I don't know if we've talked about too much or how often it's been talked about, but a homeowner assistance program provides down payment and closing cost assistance to those individuals that want to buy a home. And as we know, often when you get into a home, your home mortgage might actually be cheaper. And some of the programs that I've done in the past with the down payment assistance program has actually contributed to where the prospective homeowner doesn't have to pay the property insurance or the PMI insurance. And that could save them $60, $70 a month that they could put back for repairs or rehab as well for their home. So that really provides an avenue for homeownership and community buy-in. And then the last part is they have the Columbia County Land Trust, which is kind of what I'm talking about, land bank or land trust, where we can take those properties, compile them, target areas of infill redevelopment, and then potentially RFP out a project to a private developer who could then come in and help stabilize the neighborhoods through infill development. So the funding traditionally is broken down for their CDBG at 25 to 40% of it goes to their affordable housing stock, 20 to 50% goes to infrastructure, 10 to 50% goes to economic development. I know these can change throughout a year, but that's their averages. 0 to 30% can go to community facilities and 0 to 5% fair housing, and then 18%, up to 18% for administration. And they do that because they're allowed to do that as part of their entitlement funds. They get up to 18% they can use for staff to implement the program. The home program, they contribute on average 15% to community housing and development organizations. So this is the big one for their rehabilitation, new construction, and home buyer assistance. It averages about 75% of that funding on an annual basis, and then an additional 10% for administration. It's key to note, though, with these HUD programs, the guidelines are set to those residents that are below 80% the median family income as determined by HUD. And that changes, not a lot, but that traditionally can change every 6 to 12 months. HUD re-releases those numbers, but they're usually pretty much in the ballpark, and they're based on your income to number of occupants in your residence.
Mr. Cross, if I could just interject for one thing while you're on the revenue streams. You may recall, Mayor and Council, the TIF that was approved, the 50-plus acre development that will be anchored by a Costco. And if you recall, a portion of the proceeds from that development will go towards improving, for the most part, the third ward. And so I would not be presenting this proposed program simply if we're able to secure the funding from that project. I believe that I would be recommending council create a housing program regardless of whether that project was successful or not, because I believe that it is a strong need that exists in the community. Having said that, I do believe strongly that the project will be successful and that we will have an additional revenue stream to add to what's being reflected here. Thank you, Mr. Cross.
Sure, thank you. So to kind of cover some of the allowed job scopes that are associated with the home rehab and energy efficiency program, and I think this is kind of probably the most important to help stabilize some of the existing housing stock and keep homeowners here. Roof replacement is always a problem. It deteriorates. HVAC, that goes back to the emergency repair program. And these are all things that Columbia, Missouri does with theirs as well. HVAC for those emergency situations for your furnaces and things like that. This is another important one. And this third one can actually come from another program that HUD implements, and it's a LED program. And we're gonna look to seek funding for that. It's to remove lead-based paint from homes. It's part of a lead program. And you'll hear it called a lot, a window program, because about 90% of the work associated with this program is associated with windows, because that's where the friction comes. And the windows create that dust. It really impacts the youth of the neighborhood. As lead is really a child issue. Children under 6 are the most at risk. And when they're exposed to it, it creates developmental issues that can impact them throughout the entirety of their life. So this is one we're going to look at getting so we can assist in lead abatement throughout the community and some of the older housing stock. Some electrical and plumbing repairs is another job scope that can be completed. Accessibility improvements, this helps our elderly population that have disabilities and quite honestly can't access their home easily due to not having a ramp or a means to get a ramp. And then you have energy improvements such as attic insulation and some additional door and replacement outside of, say, the lead program. You could do some window replacement here. The other one is the acquisition and demolition. It would apply to the demolition of the properties. That's got to be a typo there. I don't think it would address the HVAC, so I apologize for that. But it would allow for grading and site preparation. And then it would also, and I think this is another important one, it would allow for repair and replacement of water and sewer connections so you could improve the infrastructure and promote basically an incentive for a private developer to come in and build on that lot, because that could save them quite a bit of money. Down payment assistance, it would be part of our homeowner assistance program, as I indicated earlier. Columbia, Missouri does 10,000. I've seen it done to 5,000, 8,000, but Columbia does $10,000. And as I had indicated previously, it addresses down payment and closing cost assistance. And one important thing about this is, though, that we would want to implement or create or partner with a home buyer education program to educate these prospective homeowner so they can have the finances to continue to stay in their home and become fiscally responsible with their money. Some of the benefits to home buyer education is, and this is just a statement that comes from HUD, is that, you know, it's basically a process that results in a potential buyer's ability to demonstrate an understanding of the following: preparing for the home ownership, budgeting and credit management, financing a home, the loan process and timing, selecting a home, maintaining a home, and finances. So that could go back to where we talked about budgeting to save for a rainy day type of fund, and avoiding delinquency and foreclosure. I think that's one that's really important, because I think once people get behind, they get the thought that the bank automatically wants to jump on it and take the home. And that's really the last thing the bank wants to do. The bank wants to work with them in any way possible to keep them in the home. And I think to provide a better understanding of that really would help some of the concerns that someone who may be having a rough time and falling a little bit behind in their mortgage has. And ultimately, in HUD study, they said it just basically improves your mortgage literacy. It gives you a greater appreciation for the communication with the lenders, and it improves the underwriting process and ultimately the credit scores of the individuals who are applying. So the question comes, where do we go? As Mr. Rose said, we've got a larger housing policy that we will be working on that's going to address neighborhood plans and various other items. But for this, for us to start to prepare, if we're going to use these funds from these types of programs in a consistent manner and know where we're going with it, I as a staff, I think we would be looking to develop our own five-year consolidated plan, something we could do in-house. I've done them before. I did them for our eligibility for our HUD funding when I was with an entitlement community. But I think we could start to build that. That'll identify, well, the first thing it'll do is it'll seek public input to help us create the programs, but then it will identify our priorities within that consolidated plan. And then I think what's really important is it will have a yearly action plan. So every year we can come back and revisit that and say, okay, this is where we did better last year. This is where we might need to improve this year to help us kind of identify and earmark funding for that year. And then ultimately an annual performance report that staff could provide to you as the council, where we are, what we've done, and how successful we've been in the year. And I think it's important to do this because if we are going to ultimately go out and apply for additional funding sources, either through St. Louis County or through the state or even federal, I think to have this type of plan really puts us on the same playing field as if we would look at our comprehensive plan, because I think it strengthens our application process in that we've shown we have a plan in place. And I think those extra points that we could potentially get from that could be enough to put us over the edge and get us some additional funding that, quite honestly, we haven't got in the past. So that's just the start and a quick analysis. I know I ran through a lot of it pretty quick, but I wanted to so I could answer any questions that you have. And with that, I'll take any questions, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. If you could take the screen sharing back, then we can see which members of council have questions. And while we do that, I know that the city manager in a few moments is going to introduce Robin Frankel. But for those who are watching, and of course for Robin, I just wanted to say welcome, Robin. And I know that Gregory will introduce you in just a second for that part of the agenda. Are there questions that are the members of council have for either Mr. Cross or for Mr. Rose?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kuzik.
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Cross, just looking at some of these numbers and doing a couple of quick rough estimates, is the you stated that the amount of money that we received from St. Louis County is $100,000. Is that inclusive of the CDBG as well as the Home Investment Partnership Program, or is that a different amount?
CDBG is what that comes from, is my understanding. And I think you remember that every June, I think Mr. Cole actually posts a public hearing on the projects that we are going to request. But yeah, the answer to your question is yes, it's CDBG.
And is that based on, do you think the allocation that we receive is based on population?
No. And this is that's where I made the point. I asked the question, and it's if it was based on census, and I was advised it was census in a formula. And let me give you an example why I have concerns with 100,000. And I haven't been into their program enough to know exactly. But the community I came from, we were an entitlement community. We had a population of 26, 27,000. Based on our census population, we received at one time the most recent one, and it had gone down significantly because those programs just really had lost money. I think in 2017, we were getting 464,000 a year just on our census there. So I want to confirm if that number accurately reflects, or if that's just a number that's been earmarked and we've just always gone after it.
That leads to my real question is, and you gave the example of Columbia, Missouri, which is receiving 974,000 plus for CDGB and home, it's 606,000 based on their population. The total of that is 1.5 million and some change. And based on their population, and you divide that, you get a rough estimate. And if you do a comparison to the population of University City compared to the population of Columbia, I estimate that we could be eligible for up to $439,000. Is that a reasonable assessment?
That's pretty close. And U City's not, much
not getting that.
Where I came from, that's pretty close. And those numbers have gone down. They go down every year. I mean, you heard rumblings in as late as 2017 that those types of programs could potentially go away, type of CDBG. But your number is pretty close to what we got with a similar population.
Thank you.
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Mayor Crow, and thank you, Director Cross, for the presentation. A few questions for you. As was just discussed, we don't receive any home funds, and it seems that at least from a third ward perspective, renovation really is the watchword. We do have all those smaller homes, they're brick homes, many of them, those on a concern list may be in need of repair, but are salvageable. I think there are only a handful that really need to go to that next step. And so to the degree that we can look for funding sources and emphasize renovation, I think we'd be very well served to do so. Of course, we've had this conversation, Councilman Smotherson and I have had this conversation with the city manager. Let me also say, I really appreciate this, the thinking behind it. It is as if Christmas came early for me, at least, because this is something that we've been talking about for a while. So really glad to see it. Can you say a couple of words about community engagement? And, you know, good news today, certainly on the COVID front, but we're not changing any practices anytime soon, I don't imagine. So can you talk about what that looks like in this environment?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously tricky. I mean, Zoom is really the only avenue that I've been working on. But now I think one important thing, you have surveys and things like that. I think one of the things we could do is we could not only coordinate like Zoom meetings, but we could get information out on this program, create an area on the website that slowly focuses on it to kind of provide updates and set up some sort of survey to seek the results. I think, you know, the key thing we truly, truly need to find, and we think we're pretty good at it because we have our occupancy permits, but I think one of the key things is for us to really bury in and start to find out what our ratio is of ownership to rental occupancy. Because most healthy communities, I think, are about a 65-35. So you need to really start to think, okay, this is what's an underlying problem? I mean, if we've got, you know, 60% rental and 40% ownership in the third ward, for example, we got to flip those numbers or target to flip those numbers. So surveys, some access to the website, education to those out there, why we're doing what we're doing and why we need their input, I think is probably the approach we'd start with.
If I could also just add on to that, we have started some of the community outreach already. We talked with members from the WIF organization that's headed by Rosalind Williams, as most of you know, who is an amazing source of information for these types of programs. But we're going to continue to reach out to other not-for-profits that are involved with this, with housing and housing development, infill and such, to ensure that we craft a program that we believe meets the needs of the community as well as is sustainable. But it will be difficult, yeah. No question, within this current environment. But you know, hopefully that won't last forever.
And just a couple more things. It's kind of obliquely referenced in this, but can you talk about vacancies and what the plan is to address those in University City, particularly the third ward?
Well, vacancy, you know, is tough because of, you know, does the owner walk away? Is it in a absentee owner who probably don't even know they own it? Say they bought 100 properties at a big sale and this is one they didn't know they own and they don't care and you send it to them. So to address vacancy, I think, you know, ultimately, if you demo them, what purpose does that serve? So you're absolutely right. We need to find a way to address vacancy. So I'm going to work with Mr. Mulligan because I believe St. Louis City has done it. And I've started to look into a potential receivership program. Now, bear in mind, and I'm not an expert on them, but I plan on doing quite a bit of research. The only problem with the receivership program is I think it takes a little time to get the ownership of the home. You know, I think one time I thought I saw up to 2 years. You can secure it and you can continue to keep it, you know, maintained. But I think there was a length of 2 years before you get control. So I'm going to work with Mr. Mulligan. But I think one of the things we do got to get more aggressive in terms of getting control of those homes. On the flip side, from a code enforcement standpoint, We've started the public hearing process and the nuisance declaration process to try to put a little more heat on those landlords or owners that just don't want to take care of them. And hopefully that pulls the absentee ones out of the woodwork. At least we can have the conversations and maybe sometimes banks will find out they have them and say, we'll give them to you. I mean, part of my program I had where I came from, we had banks that would actually come to us and they would say, here's the house plus $10,000, rehab it or demo it. If you couldn't rehab it for $10,000, it was to a state you couldn't save it. Then at the very least, we had it, the demolition paid for and control the land.
I know we have another topic. I had just one more question that I think is germane to this program. And that is, In the conversations about Olive 170, one of the concerns that came from the community is about property appreciating in the third ward in particular at a rate where the real estate taxes would become more significant than what folks on a modest income could afford to pay. Now, I personally believe that that's unlikely to have it happen given a variety of factors in St. Louis and with that housing stock. But I don't know if this is the place to inject this, but is there a way where we can, the council can kind of monitor what appreciation is doing in the third ward subsequent to the development? The development was always designed to simply return the third ward to natural levels of appreciation, depreciation. It was never designed, nor I think would it ever, you know, would we find a $70,000 home on Braddock in 5 years all of a sudden being worth $400,000 and have to pay that corresponding amount of taxes. That, I don't think that's ever going to happen. But I do want to be mindful of the concern that we are looking for trends above what we might expect for natural appreciation. Is this a place where we could put in monitoring? And I think that can manifest just simply as a report to the council on what real estate appreciation is looking like in the third ward, just to make sure that we don't, by some fluke, have situations where we're getting our current residents priced out of their homes.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility, and that goes to that CAPR, the annual report. We can have that in there where we report it to you. And we've got the ability to do it because of the GIS. I don't know if, what's it been, a year ago? I don't know if you remember, I did the tax analysis report, and I have instant access to that through the GIS. So I could do it block by block, ward by ward. If we create an entire neighborhood plan for an individual neighborhood plan, I could pull out that information and summarize what the improvement values are and how they are relating to the increase in individual property taxes throughout a targeted area.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Councilmember Clay, I just wanted to add on as well. If we get to that situation where values are ballooning, we can also work with our state legislature to enact laws that would create homesteading, so they're able to smooth those things out, so that they're, if that is their primary dwelling unit, then they can reduce the amount. The home will still appreciate, but it reduces the amount of taxes that they would actually, an individual would be required to pay. So I think that there are, and that's just one option. There are several techniques that we can pursue if we start to see that occur.
And the down payment assistance, say you don't, you remove that PMI insurance that someone pays $70, $80 a month for, automatically they've got what, $960 a year back towards any increased taxes that they would have had to pay before.
I think Mr. Smotherson has questions as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mayor Crow. Well, my question is this. This plan, it looks like what you're presenting is a general plan for the entire city. Is that correct?
It would be a general plan, but we could break out the wards or the third ward specifically, because that's going to probably be our most active ward. And I would want those numbers to create basic, not only for this, but for other types of programs where, say, we go for like what they call a section, what is it, section 108, I think, type of program. You become eligible with CDBG and HUD funds. An individual who applies traditionally is eligible either based on their income or the project itself based on the median income of an identified census tract. So we would want to specifically break out the most at-need areas, is what I'm saying, and identify those so we can qualify more people through multiple different types of approaches, so to speak.
Okay, but what I'm kind of curious about is how we identify that, because, you know, I'm just wondering how you'll be able to identify the need of the first ward, need of the second ward, and yeah, of course, the need of the third ward. But, you know, because, you know, you mentioned Columbia, and didn't Columbia, weren't they, or didn't Columbia form a task force that so that they could identify their problems? And I'm just wondering why we don't take that approach, the same approach, because I think one of the things that Columbia did was they formed a task force called Affirmatively Affirming Fair Housing. But to really understand why the third ward's in the situation that it's in, why those things are happening to the third ward, you know, because if we don't understand why, I mean, how do we ever really solve the problem if we're not understanding what's happening? Or if it's even happening in the second ward, and not saying it is happening in the first, but identifying why the third ward is in that situation, and why we keep attracting what we're attracting, and in the situation that we're in. Wouldn't a task force solve that? Help us with that, and help you with that.
Romero, Councilmember Smotherson, I think two issues regarding your question. One is we have significant information from residents of the third ward based upon the process that we used when we went through the TIF. So we accumulated a lot of information from residents regarding what they believed were the needs that existed in the third ward related to housing. But having said that, I don't know at this point what I would recommend to you regarding the creation of a task force. Initially, I think any structure that provides us with an opportunity to gain more input from not just the third ward, but from the first and second ward, because it would be a blanket policy that would apply to all wards. Any structure that enabled us to get more input, I think we should look very closely at that. But yes, so it's not to say that I would not recommend the creation of a task force, because I very well might. Tonight, though, is just really, are we headed in the right direction? Are these areas that you think we should be focusing on? And then looking at a structure later on down the road as far as how do we gain additional input from the public? And there are a number of techniques for doing that. Task force is certainly one of them.
Okay, so that's a possibility, because and that's fine. The other thing that I also wanted to mention is that you mentioned the TIF third ward and additional fund and revenue stream, but you know, and I do understand that this is a general plan, but then what would be the plan specifically for the third ward? Because those funds from TIF can only be used for the third ward, and so I don't know. I'm not sure how you can make that an additional revenue stream to a housing program that we establish.
Two issues there, Honorable Mayor Councilmember, Mayor Pro Tem Smotherson. I think that in the funding stream, you can reserve those funds for a particular area, similar to CDBG. We can only use CDBG funds in a particular area that has been approved for the use of CDBG funding. So we can restrict some of those funds, even though they may be incorporated up under the umbrella of a larger program.
Okay, just making sure we're still on the right track with that. That's all.
Yes, thank you, sir. And let me also just share with you, Mayor Pro Tem, when we went through the TIF process, we identified housing and infrastructure and public safety as the critical needs that existed in the third ward. And those are the areas that we would likely use the proceeds from that, from the project, from the Costco project for those purposes. So some of those funds would go into the housing program, up under the housing program for the third ward. Some of them would not, though. That would be outside of the housing program.
Time to move into communications. Are there other questions? Mr. Rose, do we have time to move into communications?
Mayor, we do. We wanted to take just a few minutes of your time to talk a little bit about communications broadly. I provided each of you with a copy of the plan that was presented to you in November of last year. I also invited Robin Franco, who I am contracting with for communication services. Robin has an extensive background ranging from crisis management. She's the one that is overseeing the drafting of our ROARS edition, and she's even a comic. So I am really pleased to have her on board and on my team. But I thought that opening up the conversation about what role should we have as it relates to providing information on social media, getting guidance from you on that, and invited Robin to participate in the discussion because of her background.
Thanks very much. I've spoken to most of you at least once to get your input on the Olive and 170, just as part of my orientation, both in terms of, you know, the project itself, but also tried to establish some kind of a preliminary relationship with you. And I don't know if you guys have saved my email, but I'm always interested in hearing from you if you've got thoughts or ideas that impact our communications. It could be something that you guys have already discussed or just an idea you have. I sort of have a vault that I put ideas into. And it's always interesting to me how often I dip into my vault for different purposes. I'm also a resource in terms of if you ever get contacted by the media and want some guidance, or you just want to pass that reporter on to me so that you don't have to be on the spot. Media relations is one of my sweet spots, as well as, you know, managing crisis communications. And I'm happy to talk anytime and give you a little bit of examples of different kinds of things that I've been involved with. Social media is always a big question, how to manage it. And it also gets into, I was just involved in a situation with crisis management of social media in terms of a lawyer who wanted to, on behalf of a client, go forward to everybody who'd been posting negative things on social media. And it's like, no, don't start engaging one-on-one, because that'll come back to bite you. So, you know, we can talk sometime about doing a coordinated social media strategy so that everybody benefits and the exposure is minimal. So, you know, for an introduction, that's sort of it. I don't have a plan tonight.
Robert, thank you. I think tonight is just to get comments from the mayor and council regarding what do you see as the challenges on social media as it relates to us getting information out, and how responsive do you want us to be?
Speak first on this.
Mayor, we couldn't hear you.
I apologize. Hang on.
Yeah, Mayor, it seems like when you back up, you can't be
heard. Yeah, we
as
lose
soon
you.
As you come we forward. Go like that. As soon as you come forward, you can hear you clearly.
All right. Is that better?
Yes. Yeah.
I apologize. And to the people watching, I apologize. I think we all probably struggle a bit with the social media postings because of the speed with which that we all receive the comments. And so I know that Gregory and I have had long conversations about the speed with which we reply versus our need to be more accurate than a citizen who is sitting at their computer pecking away. And I think that is a tension probably a healthy tension, if you will, that we will always have. I think with all of the developments that we have going on, I think with all that goes on in the Loop in particular, I think that we have an awful lot of engaged citizens who are clearly wired into social media. And so I do think that our postings to clarify issues, I think they're important. And I think that most of the time under the leadership of the city manager, we usually have a very good explanation as to what situation has occurred and how we addressed it. But I think many of you are far more engaged in social media than I am. And so you may want to, some of you, the rest of you may want to chime in. Stacy.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mayor. And City Manager Rose, I appreciate you bringing this topic forward. We had a conversation about this, bringing it to a study session in the council. I think I have 2 points as it relates to social media. I think, and my colleagues have heard me say this before, we need not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, meaning that we don't have to, no, we don't have to respond in 30 seconds. I don't think that's ever appropriate. But we also don't, I think, need to feel like we have to have complete information. Sometimes just saying we're aware of this situation and we will follow up with more information at a subsequent or appropriate time, I think in the short term can be very sufficient, because it simply communicates that we're aware, that we aren't oblivious to what may be occurring. And so I think as we think about a strategy and, or really more of a tactical approach, it can be done so in a tiered way. We can have an initial response that is simply an acknowledgement of the situation, whatever it may be, and then an appropriate follow-up with the kind of detail and clarity that's demanded from a municipal body. So I don't want us to feel like our first response has to be the response and a complete and exhaustive footnoted and annotated response. It can just be, hey, we heard that too, or we know what's going on. I think that might be sufficient initially. I think my other question is longer term, not counting chickens certainly before they hatch, but we got, again, some good news on the COVID front today. I think we will have some federal leadership that may change the trajectory of how things go. I think we're gonna get out of this. And I think we'll start to see some activity return. And I think our coffers will be replenished at some point. And I want to begin thinking about, what does our communication staffing look like? We know right now we have to make do, and Ms. Frankel has served ably. So this is not a criticism, but we want to get to a point where we've got a stable, sustainable communications structure. What does that look like for you, City Manager Rose, again, once we get past COVID and things return more to normal?
I don't know that I will ever see a time when I won't have Robin or someone like Robin assisting with communications for us, because I think she brings a wealth of knowledge that probably wouldn't want to have someone like her full time. I don't know that we could afford it or keep her busy enough. But those critical needs that we identify, I think that her expertise in certain areas is a huge benefit to us. So from that perspective, I think that we will always, or I would certainly recommend that we always have some sort of contractual relationship with Robin or someone like a Robin. As it relates to additional staffing, that will just be contingent upon what we see as our needs. Right now, for example, we have a need in the preparation of roars, for example, where Robin is helping us out. But that could probably be done by a lower level person as well. Crisis management, probably not going to get someone with a very broad expertise in those areas. Because they can typically make a great deal more in the private sector. So I think it will really just depend on what the needs are long term, and then what our funding capabilities are. Yeah. One of the things that you talked about is COVID and the impact. Unless something substantial changes, it is likely that we will be in this situation until likely the end of 2021. Now, that can always change. But at this point, I think that's still what they are projecting. Even if they have a vaccine that's effective, it still will take that long before you'll start to come out of where we are today.
Hales.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm looking at one of the slides that's in our packet. One of the things I think Steve could probably agree, I have spent a great deal of the last 4 weeks sharing with residents the location on the website of the Notify Me. That is a super easy thing. I think that could be more prominently posted. We often hear from people who say, well, I didn't find out about this. I didn't know. A number of residents clearly pay close attention on this, whether it's something that goes through Plan Commission or City Council, and they post updates on Nextdoor, which is great. But I do think that could be easier to find on the homepage of the website. I think Nextdoor is one of the greatest, and I hope this is just okay to share my thoughts real quick. One of the greatest things that has happen in terms of an opportunity for communication with residents. Like, we have so many people in so many of our neighborhoods that are on there. And we have strong neighborhoods across all three wards where our neighbors talk to each other, which is also great. I think that we've done a really good job in recent months and even a couple of years doing better with communicating even some of the challenging things, I think, which Stacy pointed out. I think there are lots of opportunities every week, which we have to present and talk about some of the good things that have happened, some of the problems that have been solved. And I think that's something that every department could kind of look at. You know, every week there are meetings, but there are examples of good things that happen that the people at City Hall and in our police department, fire department, in public works and streets and all of that do that I think are great opportunities to share, because these folks don't often get seen, don't often get recognized, but they're working hard every day. And then as far as the structure, I know that like on Nextdoor and on Facebook, we have city staff, particularly Nextdoor. I think we have somebody from Public Works, somebody from Planning and Development, somebody from Police. We've got various people that are posting, and I think some sort of kind of structure to that and guidance, I think it's helpful because we have people in each of those departments who are probably capable of making posts and sharing some of that good information, but they're not the experts and communications experts, and I think some guidance on... you know, I always say every post, and it didn't come from me. I was once told every post you make should add value. And I think we're doing a great job doing that, but I'd like to see this kind of continue in the direction that it's been going for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, I think that in responding to you, Councilmember Hales, I think it perhaps better addresses Councilmember Clay's question as well. I think that having at some point a communications manager that can oversee all of our communication effort, probably appropriate to do so. And then I think that's the structure that you're looking to have in place, where we have at least one individual that's going to be the point person for managing whether we have a contract or whether they are doing the actual work themselves, such as putting together roars or an internal newsletter or press releases and such. So I do believe that would be appropriate. I'm just hesitant to say at this point that person should be a director level, because I think that we get better experience by contracting that some of those things out, because that individual does it on a day-to-day basis, dealing with crisis, you know, and other things. So I think at a minimum, though, having at some point a communications manager is a wise thing.
Ms. Klein.
Yeah, I just had a question about the interactiveness of the city and on social media, because I know the city puts posts out. They put posts on Nextdoor and UCD on the record, but I don't know if there's really a forum for people to ask questions to the city, or if there's someone that would do that, or the police department, for example, because I know that they also have posts. And I'm just wondering if that's interactive, or if it's just kind of, here's the information.
For the most part, our approach is, Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Klein, has been simply to say, here's the information. A good example is shots fired. We recently started posting on Nextdoor. Now, we're aware of this. Here's what has happened as a part of our investigation. It's not really interactive, because we think that if it's going to be interactive, it's better to have either through a call or through an email versus having that discussion on social media. But that's a part of, I think, a broader strategy that I'll be working with Robin on relative to, you know, what should we be doing for social media? Because it's not going away. So it's something that we're going to need to get better at managing. But the reason I'm hesitant to actually have an interaction is because we would truly like to drive individuals to where they can get complete and accurate information. And typically that's not on social media. But I do understand that, you know, a lot of people use it. So I do believe we need a presence. It's just, what level of presence should we have?
Well, we need to bring this to a conclusion here. Robin, do you have anything you'd like to say? I don't want to put you on the spot. And just if we'll be moving on to our public session in just to our regular session in just a moment.
Right. No, I mean, again, just reiterate that when you have ideas, whether it's about social media or anything, feel free to send me an email, because all this stuff goes into a vault. And as I work on a strategy with Mr. Rose, I'll be dipping into that vault. So I appreciate your input.
Mayor, I'm sorry. I don't know if I have shared this with you and the council. One of the projects that I've assigned to Robin is the creation of a communication strategy for the city. That was where she initially started out with discussions with each of you. A component of that strategy will focus on social media, but we're not ready at a point where we can present that strategy yet.
Right.
Everyone, thank you very much for joining us. We will adjourn the study session and start back up in about 5 minutes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.